Yeah, you'll need that. Did you test it out, make sure it was working?
Church greeting. Welcome, everybody. How many people found us from the meetup group that we started a couple weeks ago? One, two, three. Does it help? Any feedback on how we can make that better? You got your emails, you know all about it, find the network, yes. Couple of things, announcements. Who hasn't paid? Pay Carlos $5, or you can buy the season pass, $35. What a bargain for most of the year. Don't forget to pay for your dinner. Please, some of y'all walk out paying for dinner last time. All right, I'm proud to welcome my friend Jack Youngkin, home team intellectual. Jack has a BBA in management from the University of North Texas. He's had a career in management consulting, Arthur Andersen, Price Waterhouse, Deloitte. His philosophical interests are existentialism. His heroes, Friedrich Nietzsche, Thomas Paine, George Orwell. Please welcome Jack Youngkin.
Well, thank you. It's already been pointed out that possibly only about 1% of the world's population thinks critically. So I said, well, that's why I'm talking about it. There's so much potential for improvement that you know, it's a universal topic. But there are a couple of people tonight that came after going through a two-month workshop that we did on this topic, and I appreciate them for enduring it one more time, and they've got this kind of memorized by heart, so hopefully they'll help out with the presentation. In fact, part of the presentation is interactive, so I have some information on some slides, and you can read, you know, I think, hopefully, and so I don't have this thing, you know, I really don't read the slides, but I'm going to, at points during the presentation, ask for your participation, and that actually your participation will sort of help this really go great or maybe not so. Okay, so thinking critically. So we're going to tonight ask the questions about what is it, why do we need it, and then how do we do it? So the word critical comes from a Greek word that means to question, make sense of, and to be able to analyze. And it's the root for the word criticize, which we tend to think of in sort of a negative way. But there's kind of a constructive way to look at critical in the sense that we're evaluating. Okay, we're analyzing, we're trying to get a better understanding of what's going on. So Francis Bacon said, it's desire to seek, patience to doubt, fondness to meditate, slowness to assert, readiness to consider, okay, carefulness to dispense and set in order, and hatred for every kind of imposter. Okay, even my Republican friends. I said that for Mr. Allkeck. So what is it? Well, so it's carefully exploring the thinking process. So part of tonight is thinking about thinking and how we do that. And then how do we make sense of the world? I mean, since you know, human beings have been able to sort of have some thought about what's the universe about and what's our role in it, what does it mean? Okay, we're trying to make sense. We're always trying to make sense of the world that we live in, and so how can we improve our thinking. So hopefully I'll give you some ideas about that and you'll also help out as well. So critical thinkers are some of these things. What else might a critical thinker be? Okay, besides what I have here. Any other ideas or suggestions? Open-minded, knowledgeable, mentally active, curious, independent, skilled, insightful, self-aware.
Skilled discussant. Is that a word?
That is a word.
It is.
Skilled discussant, yes. Somebody said something?
I said confused.
Confused?
Inquisitive.
Okay. Inquisitive. Okay. Challenging? Any challenge? Okay, analytical. That's pretty natural. Okay, so, you know, probably when we, you know, we all have our different idea of what we think the critical thinkers are, or we tend to think that we're thinking critically and the other people aren't. So let's kind of keep that idea in mind and see if we can challenge that a little bit. So why do we need it? And if we ever really considered, why do you need to think critically? Okay, so I've got some ideas. There's a lot of them. Achieve goals, solve problems, you know, think about ethical and moral issues. What other ideas do you have? Why do we need to think critically?
Might save your life.
Could save your life? Okay, that's a good one. I mean, when you live back when, you know, lions and tigers were chasing you,
yeah,
that sort of thing. Yeah, okay. Carl?
Live a better life.
Okay, live a better life. Good,
great. I was thinking of it as testing, like you're testing some proposition to see if it's true.
Okay.
The idea of being find out truth and false.
Okay, great. Okay. All right. Well, those are all good ideas. And we could probably, if we really, you know, put our minds to it, we could come up with another list, you know, twice as long as this. But the one that really appealed to me as I was kind of putting this together a few months back was really how do we as individuals really know that we're being authentic to ourselves? How do we really know ourselves? You know, how do we know that our thinking is original? How do we know it's creative? How do we know it's our thinking versus someone else's thinking? So kind of keep that idea in mind. So there are several factors that impact the ability to think critically, and I've, you know, come up with a list, and again, we could think of, I'm sure, twice as many as this, but tonight we have limited time to investigate all these different factors. So I kind of had two options. I could either talk about each one of these factors a little bit, or I could talk about one or two of them a little more. So I chose the latter strategy of kind of diving into a couple of them a little bit deeper, and that being the first two, perception and beliefs. Now, they're all probably equally interesting. They're all, to some extent, valid or important to the way we, you know, think critically. So I'm not putting any priority on these two, but I had to pick a couple, so those are the ones that I chose. So what is perception? Okay. Well, excuse me. We have to either consciously or unconsciously decide what to pay attention to. Okay, what are we, you know, in our awake state, to some extent, we're actually paying attention and we're consciously perceiving things, and then a lot of the stuff in the environment, maybe even most of it, we might be perceiving unconsciously. And then, you know, our mind, our brain organizes all these sensual inputs, okay, into some kind of a structure, some kind of a pattern that we can understand. And this is probably much more unconscious than conscious, although we can choose to concentrate or pay attention or focus and maybe impact that sensing partially. Okay, and then how do we interpret that? And that's probably a little bit more where consciously, if we're really, making the attempt to think about the inputs we're getting and applying our experience, our knowledge, our innate capabilities, okay, we're trying to make some kind of sense out of all this data that's coming in. Okay, so tell me what you see here. Okay, two ladies. Did everybody see the two ladies?
I see one.
Okay, which one do you see?
The woman with the dark hair looking that way.
Old or young?
Can't really tell. Dark hair, a little bit of a nose.
Okay, so the right answer is two.
Yeah.
Okay, and one of the women is young, attractive. And then the other one's kind of old and not so attractive.
Yeah.
Everybody kind of getting that?
Mm-hmm.
Here's the young woman's profile right here. See that? But now if I look at this, and if I look at this instead of being the necklace, it's being the mouth of the old woman, then I get this old, big nose. You getting it now?
Yeah.
Try another one. This one's easier. What is this?
Oh, one view is a duck.
A rabbit or a duck?
It's a rabbit duck, right?
It's a rabbit.
Yeah, it could be a rabbit.
Walks like a duck, quacks like a duck,
but looks like a rabbit.
Here, depending on where you focus your eyes, right or left, you pick up different. I can see Alkek straining back there. He's visually challenged with this. All right, so. You look over here, this kind of looks like a rabbit with the ears, and if you kind of look over here, it looks kind of like a duck, right, with an eye. All right? Again, this is visual, making some sense out of the input and the patterns. So let's talk about, for a minute, the role of vision, which is a big part of our perception. And recently I've been reading a book by a neuroscientist, Eric Kendall, The Age of Insight. And he's done a lot of research, some of it original, some of it not. But he kind of goes through a good synthesis of what we know about how our vision works. So on the retina, okay, on our eye, okay, we actually have a flat two-dimensional image. And then that image is carried through a couple of pathways that address either color or the location of whatever it is that we're perceiving. All right? And Kendall says that then this information goes to like 30 different areas in the brain, and that in turn creates, again, that's the key word, when you say I'm seeing something, your brain is creating a three-dimensional image in your brain that we call seeing. That's our vision. So, this is a familiar idea, right? Seeing things through rosy-colored glasses. So we see through lenses. We literally see through lenses, and if you're like me, you see through a couple pairs of lenses. Okay. But have you ever noticed how interesting it is that different people can be looking and even listening to the same, seeing the same phenomena or listening to the same phenomena and have totally different interpretations, impressions? Have you ever had that experience? Anybody have an example? Mm-hmm. From your personal experience where that's happened, where you were looking at something and you saw something and somebody saw something? Any thoughts about? No?
When you're talking to your girlfriend.
Do what?
When you're talking to your girlfriend.
Oh, you're talking to
your girlfriend. You're saying something and she's thinking something totally different.
Okay. Well, I hadn't thought about that one, but that's
it's a totally different perception.
That's totally a male perspective there.
Oh, yeah. No.
So the key idea, and I think we all know this, either overtly or at least intuitively, we know that we all have different lenses, but yet we somehow seem to want to either think that we're right, or our view of the world is right, or we have the perception of reality that is the perception, and the other person doesn't. Okay? And what we're going to find out is that's a pretty natural way of thinking. So, you know, I don't. What do you think about this? It's critical thinkers are aware of their lenses. Anybody aware of their lenses?
Sometimes.
Okay.
Sometimes.
Do you have an example or?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, a lot of this can be viewed through Christianity.
Okay.
And Christianity changes a lot of those lenses, and those lenses are very, well, as I'm exposed to more different views, I'm exposed to other people's lenses and how they perceive this. And so this is also very, very true.
Okay.
But my own lens is it would be very controversial for someone who didn't have it, and not so controversial for someone who did have it.
Okay, over here.
I just like to add an example. For example, if I say Hinduism is an idolatry, I don't think any one of you would be offended. But if I say Christian mythology, I think a lot of you who are religious would probably be stoned in the that is the different lenses that we see the world through.
Yeah, good. There was another hand back here.
I like to use the difference between seeing and observing.
Okay.
Some people see a lot of things, but they don't really observe it.
What do you mean by that?
Well, Sherlock Holmes was talking to Dr. Watson one day, and he said, "Watson, you can't come up the steps to our apartment, our rooms, every day. How many steps are there in the steps?" "I have no idea." He said, "You see the steps, but you have not observed them." and I think it's a cultural thing. You know, my wife and I, we've gone somewhere, we've seen somebody. I said, "Did you notice what he or she was wearing?" Or,
right.
"Did you notice that, you know, she had acne or whatever?" You know, because I observe things different than she does. So I think it's a cultural or personal thing. There are some people who are attuned to observing things different than others.
Mm-hmm. And specific things. I mean, each one of us tends to have preferences, you know, or things that we favor, or things that maybe even are offensive that we would notice that are different from the other person. So, but you know, we think that, you know, I think we often think that our take on reality is reality, right? There is as many versions of reality in this room as there are people, right? But yet again, there's this propensity to think that we know what reality would be. So a little different thing here, or another extension then of the visual thing, is to kind of go into the area of the visual arts, like, you know, painting or sculpture or photography, whatever, that there's a thing called the beholder share. And unfortunately, my friend Mr. Berman is not here tonight, because I'd love to discuss this with him. But for a long time in the philosophy of art, it was about what does the artist intend? What's the intention of the artist? Or is the artist trying to convey something? And then as time went on, we began to ask the question, well, what is the beholder or what is the perceiver's response to that work of art? Okay, so artists, you know, learning that the visual system works in certain strange ways, and learning this over time, okay, throughout history, have determined ways to manipulate or to utilize our innate design, if you will, of how our visual system works. And you know, the Gestalt is about how we see things against the background or how things interact with the elements. And again, in our visual view, we have so many things coming into view, but we have to have some way of ordering those things and putting them in perspective. And that, you know, the depth perception that we have, again, is created very interesting. I mean, if you're interested in this topic, Kendall's book is really excellent at explaining how the visual system does that. Okay? And, you know, our brain actually makes up some of the stuff. You know, how does, I mean, you know, several months ago we had a musician from Austin College talk to us. The guy was really effective. But you think about the, you know, magicians have learned how our brains and vision works, and they're able to manipulate that because the brain anticipates certain things to happen when we make certain movements. Okay, so Messerschmitt was a German-Austrian sculptor. And his sculpting, to say the least, draws some pretty, you know, visceral reactions from a lot of people. What is the bust on the, what is that person doing?
Screaming.
Screaming? That's the number one response. Any other ideas?
Yawning.
Yawning, okay.
Singing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, actually, the title of this one here is the yawner. Okay, how about the one on the right?
That's something sour.
Something sour. Oh, yes.
He's trying to keep from laughing.
He's trying, or sneezing.
Or sneezing.
Yeah, trying to keep from
crying.
Yeah.
Crying. Okay. Good. Any others?
Hurt.
He's in pain. That's what I was thinking. This person looks like they're grimacing. Okay. So you haven't gotten it yet. Okay, well, anyway, he entitled this one The Arch Villain. Okay, so that was his interpretation. So, you know, what's really interesting about Messerschmitt is that he possibly suffered from Crohn's disease. And so he sort of developed this thing from sort of, you know, the discomfort and all that, but he would pinch himself. And he would look at himself in the mirror, and he would come up with these different grimaces. And his busts are based on 64 different grimaces that he was able to come up with. But if you notice, each of you had a particular preference for your interpretation, at least your initial interpretation of what you thought that facial expression was doing.
Are they the same person?
I'm sorry?
Are they the same person?
I don't think so. Other than him, he was his own model.
Oh, okay.
But yeah. Yes.
I think it's interesting that he could either look at it, as, you know, in a positive viewpoint or a negative viewpoint.
Okay. Yes.
Some people are going to look at it and see the guy was smiling. Mm-hmm. Some people are going to look at it and see the guy was frowning.
Right.
You know, so that's
interpretation.
That's your lens.
Evaluation. Lenses.
Yes.
Right. Absolutely. Okay. So. Klimt. Who was Klimt? Anybody know who Klimt was? Austrian. Okay, Klimt was really the first almost expressionist. Okay, the expressionists came after the impressionists, and he had kind of had a couple of other students in Austria that became well-known expressionists. But so two different paintings. One on the left. Okay, obviously. Is a female figure. This happens to be a well-known socialite in Austria in the early 1900s. But what's your reaction, or what do you see about this painting that strikes you?
She doesn't look particularly happy.
Boy. Okay, so it's flat. Okay, it's very flat against the background. She doesn't look happy. Anybody else have a response to her facial expression? Well, you know, this is really... I know it's hard for you in this back of seat.
She looks very sort of seductive. Okay. Kind of different from your impression.
But the idea, I mean, look at the eye. So what happens with our perception of individuals? The way we are able to lock in on their face and their perception is, and we do this, again, unconsciously, but obviously because the eyes are where they are located on everyone's head, we really tend to focus in on the eyes first to get the orientation of the individual. How about lines in this painting? What do you think about the lines?
Those are her hands. Her arms are too long.
Her arms are too long. Okay.
Those are her hands.
Okay. I mean, are you able to kind of perceive lines here? You are, to some extent, but we don't really have a line, a black line, for instance, drawn. But because the shading is different, the texture is different, whatever, we are able to pick up and make borders, okay, in line. Another visual thing. What about her body? It's too small for her head? Okay. I mean,
yeah.
No form, okay. But yet you kind of, because it sort of has the shape, sort of, okay, I guess that's really, it's below her head. Okay, although her head looks a little bit disconnected here. She's kind of got this big collar thing on.
No shoulders.
Yeah, no shoulders at all. Okay. And there, so what about, I mean, in the back you can't see this, but what are these other little things in here?
Cliff liked to put a realistic face with all kinds of patterns that didn't go with it. I mean, clloves and clloves and whatever that were patterns.
Okay.
And they were not realistic, except the face was.
How does this type of expressionist style of painting sort of differ from classical painting? Pretty different, huh? Okay. And in this particular picture, the face looks fairly normal, but some of the expressionists painted portraits of individuals where their faces were really distorted, even ugly, to traditional ways of looking at things, and like their hands might be too big or real knobby or something, because they were playing on the idea that art's not all about beauty. You know, it's not all about the Greek idea. Okay, there is a way, or in the real world, we have both beauty and we also have what we call maybe not beauty, but it impacts our emotion differently. All right, let's talk about this landscape. What do you see here?
Flowers, trees.
Okay, where are the trees?
Well, some trees in the back, some trees in the foreground.
Okay, so these trees are pretty easy to make out, but how about this
one? Well,
that
looks like a tree.
This one, you can have that over here. This one's a little...
It could be a tree.
It's got aerial perspective. Aerial perspective.
Aerial perspective. What do you mean by that?
The colors in the back are bluer as the further back you go.
Okay, so one of those channels we talked about earlier, which is the color channel, is working in conjunction also with trying to figure out the spatial part. But the spatial part here, and I haven't figured out what this is back here yet. I mean, this looks like a tree that's got a chunk out of it or something. I don't know. Anyway, but the idea here is that your vision has the power to influence, okay, your perception, but it's also based on a lot of other things from your education, your environment, your direct experience, and so forth. So going from perception, let's talk about some conceptual blocks, and then we'll kind of come back and finish up the perception idea. So these conceptual blocks then are things that maybe keep us from sensing or recognizing or evaluating, interpreting what's going on in the environment. So Plato, in one of the dialogues, was saying, he's talking to Socrates, or Meno is, he's saying, oh, Socrates, how will you look for it if you don't know what it is? I mean, you don't know what you're looking for, so how will you know when you find it? So, noticing or perceiving, okay, one reaction is, we know it's one of them. We know it's one of them. Absolutely, unequivocally, it's one of them. We just know. Or it kind of maybe looks like one of them, but I'm not sure. Maybe in depth. Or I don't know what it is, but I've never seen one before. So what does this one sort of imply? It means I'm seeing something. I don't have anything in my experience that tells me what it is, but I'm acknowledging at least I'm seeing things. And then, as opposed to the last one, I didn't notice anything, which I love that one.
Sure.
Okay. So, there's, you know, different types of emotional blocks. And unfortunately, this is a whole subject into itself that we're not going to be able to explore very deeply. But I did want to kind of link in to the perceptual blocks, and we were talking about perception and talk about what they are. So, there's been tons of research done in the last few years about people expecting to see, to hear, to interpret what they expect to see. I mean, I think it's, you know, it's just something now that we understand very well. Okay, what are your expectations, and that's what you're going to see. So we have names for these. Stereotyping. Give me an example of stereotype.
Trying to approach things differently from the way
that I. Okay. There's lots of stereotypes. Come on.
Racial prejudice.
Okay. Think. Well, this is critical thinking. Come on. Get those brains
educational
working.
Educational prejudice.
Okay. Some educational.
Prejudice.
Okay.
Generational.
Okay. All right. Confirmation bias. We're going to talk about confirmation and bias and deniability a little bit more. So we'll kind of voice of judgment. What do you think that is?
Should.
Oh, you should.
I should be thinking this, or I should be thinking.
Oh, yeah. See, that's a man. I'm not going to say who it is, but I have somebody that tells me I should have. You should have. Okay. I was actually thinking about something else. I have had this propensity myself to tell myself that I can't do something. Okay, it's like, man, that's really cool, but, you know, I don't have the talent, or I don't have the mental capability, or I don't have the resources. So I'm always having this talking in my head that tells me that I can't do something, and it's really kind of been an interesting thing to work on that and sort of overcome that. Okay, and then there's others, okay? The inability to see a problem from various viewpoints. And, you know, Craig talked about that earlier, that by, you know, as we investigate and understand other points of view, we are able to see things from different viewpoints. But, you know, often we probably kind of have our default viewpoint, and that really sets up the framework for the way we, you know, take in information. Okay, so any other thoughts about perception? Conception. You know, one of the quotes that I didn't have on the screen, but I really like, has to do with the way we see things, in the sense that it kind of goes something like this: seeing things one way means not seeing them another. I think that's kind of a neat idea. Okay, having a, you know, we have a point of view. There's a guy named Fleck that talks about thought collectives. He was kind of a predecessor to Thomas Kuhn and the scientific paradigms. And he talked about these thought collectives were basically, you can think of it like a scientific school, if you will,
that's used to looking at things, looking at the universe a certain way, and having certain thought styles, and those thought styles lead to certain ways that the world is perceived and interpreted, and that over time we have breakthroughs or we have different ideas that come forth that change those thought styles. Okay. Yeah.
Well, you can have more than one. I mean,
yes.
I mean, you could have your way. You have several other ways that you right. know about how they would think of.
And we do.
And that's the difference between a person that's probably been around a little bit and listened to some others and someone who hasn't.
Or I could be a member of kind of different groups, right? I mean, I could be the member of maybe a professional group that has a certain thought collective or thought style. I could be the member of a scientific community. I could be the member of a religious community. You're right. I'm in a group with a bunch of dads that got together, whatever.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so now we're going to move on to belief and try to stay on schedule. And so I think this is a really interesting topic to be belief, especially this fall, being that it is a political season. I think this is a really interesting topic. But the acceptance that a statement is true or that something exists, we accept it as being real. It's a firmly held opinion or a conviction. Okay, maybe we place a lot of trust or confidence in certain individuals or certain philosophies, okay, certain scientific methods. Could be good. Maybe it's a certain approach to the interpretation of information, okay? And From that, we make predictions about the world that we live in. Okay, so anybody else have a different thought or different idea, different definition of belief?
Well, there's one.
Okay.
Leading Edge Research, I think they're based in Washington, have a statement. I forget exactly how it goes, but belief is stronger than steel, and no amount of evidence will ever change it. That's what we're putting it.
That's right.
Once somebody has a belief.
It's just like I was having this email debate with someone this week that had to do, there's no amount of evidence or rational or reasoned thinking that can overcome true belief. Okay, so knowledge and truth. So in our culture, maybe this is less true than it used to be, but I can see where it was really true at one time, is that we have been educated and socialized to believe, okay, that knowledge and truth are absolute and unchanging. Okay, so we kind of had the style of I'm teaching, okay, I'm the teacher, you're listening, you learn, I teach. You don't question, I teach. So, critical thinkers then would take the responsibility themselves to sort of resist this, engage their own minds in a fully active and open and selective choosing type of learning process. So, as I said earlier, actually Carl did in the introduction, Thomas Paine's one of my favorite guys, and he talks about a couple of different quotes here, a long habit of not thinking a thing wrong gives it a superficial appearance of being right. So, tell me some people that practice this. Well, politicians. If a politician just, if I just keep saying the same thing over and over again, whether it's true or not, if I say it often enough, people will start believing it. Okay, and they do. They kind of get lazy and they don't really question things. Okay, another quote. Neither is it proper that I should take the word of man as the word of God and put man in the place of God. Now, this is not just, I didn't bring this up just for
for it to be a religious statement, but I'm hoping that you can sort of extrapolate from the idea here about, do we just take other people's word for it? Yes, no, maybe. Sometimes.
Consider it.
Huh?
You consider their word.
Okay. And in what cases would you maybe give credence to it?
Well, if they were supposedly, if they were an expert
okay.
in some area.
Okay, that makes sense.
They might be worth listening to. Of course, they may just claim to be an expert. But.
Okay. How about if they had been maybe an eyewitness to something?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, obviously, being an eyewitness can have different interpretations, but at least if they had been there, you know, I was reading another article somebody said, I guess I attract these people who want to challenge me all the time about my ideas, but it's about, there's apparently some neuroscientist at Harvard that recently had a near-death experience and had really taught neuroscience in a very scientific way, but then had this, he lost consciousness and was in a state of unconsciousness and apparently traveled to the outer realm and now, you know, thinks there's something else going on out there and then came back, okay, regained his consciousness. And so in that case, there's an individual that's had an experience, and there's no doubt they had the experience. I mean, we've all had vivid dreams, but, you know, it's kind of like, how do you interpret that individual's experience and what it really means? So some things are just not clear-cut, right? They're not all, it's not always easy to say yes or no about someone's thing, so that's where our judgment, our critical thinking comes in. So, well, some beliefs are better than others, right? Okay. So we can ask these questions. I mean, it's like part of the presentation is how do we think critically? How do we do these things? So let's think about some questions that we can. So how effective do your beliefs explain what is taking place? Okay. So what's the problems with that question?
Do you have
what's some good things with it, the question?
Well, do you have all the information?
Okay.
Because your belief is going to be the cause of it.
Say again?
Your belief is going to be the cause of it, nothing else.
You okay.
Stay strong, you don't really take any information. If you believe in that, so just go with what you believe in. And you don't really look at outside sources or anything.
So what's a technique for dealing with that particular question then? How could I?
Well, it assumes you know what is taking place. I mean, you've got to question what you...
Well...
Your interpretation of what is taking place.
Okay, what might be another way? I mean, obviously, if it's one individual talking about their beliefs, and there's going to be one interpretation, but I know Brian's going to help me out here.
Well, I guess you would always ask other alternative explanations for what you're thinking is taking place, and that would be with respect to the first one. To what extent are these beliefs consistent with other beliefs? And that really depends on how much experience you've had of a whole lot of events and how they make a consistent picture. But also, you're interpreting them in terms of models that other people have made on how things work. Sociologists, if you're talking about people's behavior, or psychologists, or physicists about material things, so you really never take anything as absolutely true, but you evaluate it in the context of a whole lot of other criteria. And so what you have, I think, is various degrees of certainty. And some things you can be very certain of, but not like the sun's going to rise tomorrow morning.
Right.
And some things you can't be certain of about who's going to win the election.
That's for, yeah, so I take it, Brian, that you're not a fundamentalist because you take things provisionally. But absolutely, some things we commonly observe easily in our environment and we can all agree on, okay, and we have some experience. Like all of us probably drive and we know when we turn the steering wheel the car's going to turn, Are we confident that we push on the brakes? You know, the brakes are going to work. You know, and we have no idea, you know, what the mechanical design of the brakes are and what really makes it happen, but we just know through our experience of repetition over and over again and shared experience that it's going to happen. David, you were going to say something?
I'm sure you're going to get into this, but...
I wouldn't assume that.
Whether we put prejudice in a source, you know, or be critical of the source, like the scholastics, you know, for hundreds of years, you know, Aristotle said so-and-so, or the church fathers said so-and-so,
right.
Or the Bible said so-and-so, therefore, that's the truth, that's the knowledge, you know. And so that's the way it was presented, and so people believed it that way until Descartes and Bacon, you know, came up with, you know, a critical way, a scientific way of doubting those sources, you know, and putting your belief into what you can observe and what you can show experimentally and that sort of thing. So,
and there's been many times in history and in situations where there have been, you know, governments or institutions, whatever, that have basically said, look, we own the truth, and, you know, it's not acceptable that you would contradict this truth, and if you do, we're going to cut your head off. Okay, so, you know, we've had that. So we have another hand over here.
Yeah, I'm... saying the word effectively and wondering what exactly that means, because it seems to me like you could have a very consistent system, a very coherent system that was still not in line with the truth at all.
Okay, so if I mean, I think this one is good in the sense that if we can predict that an event or a state is going to occur fair, you know, with a high degree of probability, then the higher the probability, the closer to truth, maybe, that thing. Okay, for instance, if I take an ice tray and I put water in it and I stick it in the freezer and I leave it in there for 2 hours, whatever, and when I take it out, the water has turned to ice, it's hard, and, you know, how many times do I have to do that before I can predict that if I do that again, you know, it's kind of like me putting my foot on the brakes, right? So, I mean, effectively, I think it's somewhat measured by probability, in my view. Okay.
But the first one, how effectively do you believe explain what is taking place? Well, the first question you ask is how many beliefs do you explain? And if you don't explain very many of them, then that puts it in a limited view. But if you explain most of them effectively, then that's more impressive.
I think I agree that it's more impressive, but I think if I was good at rhetoric, okay, good in persuasion, and I was clever, I might could come up with a bunch of good explanations for my beliefs that may or may not be based in any type of evidence, or they may not be testable or falsifiable. I mean, I think that would be possible.
On the surface, it would be, but with enough examination, it would finally fall apart.
Yeah, I mean, it does over time. I mean, it's just like the paradigms of science, okay, and the solar system and so forth. I mean, a lot of people said the same thing for a long time. If they got more information, they kept gathering that information, they got better instruments to do better observations, and over time they changed their mind. There's another hand over here.
Well, I think part of how you determine your belief system is being open to being challenged.
Okay.
You should be accepting that there's a possibility that you could be wrong, and to not just dismiss everything, all other points of view out of hand.
Okay, one more, we're going to move on, because I want to, that kind of is going to lead, and we're going to talk about confirmation bias here, which is kind of a neat topic.
Right. Yeah, I think this lady said something about systems which are self-consistent that are different from other people's. And I think your bottom line there said beliefs are falsifiable. I don't really agree. I think a lot of these sorts of beliefs, which are the alternate systems that make a lot of sense,
they're unfalsifiable. There's no way that you can test to see what the consequences will be of one way of believing things as opposed to another. I mean, I could say that there's a tiger in this room.
Mm-hmm.
It's an invisible tiger, and you can't smell it, and you can't see it, I can't hear it, but nevertheless, there's a tiger in this room, and you can't prove me wrong.
How would I know? I don't know what I don't know.
That's right.
I don't know what I don't know. Okay, so where they come from, direct experience, indirect experience, okay, the flat earth, okay, so forth. Let's kind of go on to the confirmation bias. So, there are people like, and the people that know me know I talk about Jonathan Haidt quite a bit, but people like Jonathan Haidt, who's a psychologist from Virginia, and other people, not just him, have in the last 20 years or so done a lot of research that says that we have this very strong propensity, this kind of almost innate tendency, okay, to find evidence and create reasons to support what we already believe or what we already feel or what we already think is right, okay? So any thoughts about that observation? I mean, it's a very strong driving tendency for all human beings.
Mm-hmm.
And to really get into thinking critically, this is probably one of the hardest things to overcome, I think. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm open to challenge on that. But any...
Right.
No, I said I agree.
You're just agreeing?
If, for example, if you truly believe in a God that will protect you, and if there's a tornado that goes around and happens to hit every other house except yours, and you would be like, hey, you know, God is
right.
Looking out for me. And I just, it will confirm, it will strengthen your belief. But is it true or not?
Yeah, I wasn't thinking about he wasn't looking out for all those other people. But, okay, so, and then another kind of related thing is the whole idea of deniability, which kind of comes with this in the sense that if we have this tendency to confirm our beliefs or to be selective in the data we collect, and we would also have a tendency to exclude or ignore other evidence that might contradict the truth, okay, or what we want innately to do. Okay, and the research shows that actually confirmation bias is very effective in argumentation up to a point. Because, especially if you have strong confirmation bias, you really are, you know, emotionally invested in your beliefs, so you tend to be very convincing in your arguments. However, there's a lack of anticipation of what the counter-arguments could be to your arguments. There, you had a comment? Somebody over here had their hand up.
Craig? It depends on how effectively you answer those confirmation biases. In other words, if you thought about them, they take you by surprise, and that's one thing. They don't take you by surprise, and you have thought about them, then that's one in your favor.
Mm-hmm.
And it depends on what you, the time you use to do that. You can only do that for one or two things, for a few things, to go that deeply into it. So, the point is, what is worth doing?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Here's another interesting sort of related behavior that goes along with this. And as soon as I say this, you're going to think of someone, not yourself, but somebody else you know who is like this or that has done this. Is that you can basically provide individuals with contradictory evidence or information that would contradict or that would dispute their belief, and what do they tend to do? Well, not only that, but
get mad,
okay?
Discredit.
Okay, and they'll come up with all kinds of arguments and schemes and ways to discredit what you've provided.
I was going to actually flip the tornado example. Say a tornado comes through and hits only that person's house.
Ah.
Like he happened to be at the store at that time, so he
he's like, well, look, I got saved. My house was destroyed, but I'm still alive. And it doesn't matter that nobody else got hurt. That's a really strong confirmation bias. He's not taking any other contextual clues into account in that situation.
So we're kind of getting away from what I was just talking about, but let me make one other comment. You know, through history, that happened a lot, right? Is that, you know, especially more primitive peoples, you know, when we had lightning and it struck my tent, or the volcano blew up, you know, somehow the gods were mad at me, or it must have been intended, or whatever. And so that's where, of course, a lot of superstitions came from as well. But what I was getting at about confronting people with additional information about their beliefs that might tend to contradict them or even refute them is they will have a tendency, one, to reject the information, even though you can demonstrate that the information is valid or true, if you will. And the other thing is they will believe what they believed before even stronger than they did before you gave them the information. Does that ring true?
Oh, yeah.
See a lot of heads? Okay. I'm not going to name any names tonight. Okay. So thinking critically about beliefs is that we really have to recognize the interplay between all these factors. I mean, it's a very complex area. There are some people who have latched on to ways to make things concrete or to anchor themselves in something concrete, because the world does have a lot of maybe contradictory information or whatever. And so we've got, you know, one coping style or one coping method is that we just find a religion, or we find a philosophy, or we find some art that will give us solidity. Okay, I mean, the one reasons like church wanted to promote art, especially art about a particular religion, is that by making that visual, it gave it some form of being concrete. People could see it, and it was real. It wasn't just something that we talk about. Okay, so we have to take responsibility as critical thinkers, then, to continuously be diligent about monitoring this information. So, kind of wrapping things up tonight, we could say, well, who am I? Okay, so there's three areas I want to talk about very quickly. One is the one area we've been talking about, thinking critically. The other is, you know, how to live creatively, and then how to choose freely. So clear thinking is a tool. And I'll get back to the thing about authenticity, which I think is a really important issue. It always has been, but I think today with the kind of consumer treadmill that the world is on, in the media and so forth, that it's very difficult to really know who we really are. What are our real goals that we have? And is it really my goal? Or am I just existing? Am I just responding to the environment? So, you know yourself. Be aware about, I mean, be conscious of the, you know, it's not easy. This self-critique is probably not something that the most of us don't really enjoy doing all that much. But on the other hand, I think Carl, I think his goal was great, is to live a better life, that taking this approach to thinking critically really could be key instrumental to that. So kind of going from that to about how to live creatively. So we approach life with a sense of discovery and invention, okay? It's, you know, we're not approaching life as just taking in information or processing it or just having the same beliefs over and over again, but we're trying to break out of our conditioned thinking that we have and challenge that thinking and do new things, okay? you know, give yourself an art date, maybe. Go to a museum that you've never been to and clear your mind and try to experience something new, okay? But take responsibility for that. And then it's really about us being able to choose freely. And this is so difficult. I mean, I think most of us think that we are choosing freely. And then I start examining, you know, I kind of do the same things over and over again. I watch the same programs over and over again. I listen to the same music. So it's kind of like there's a pattern here of this kind of conditioned thinking that's so easy to... But I think, you know, whatever philosophy, whether it's Miss Rand, okay, or whoever, okay, freedom to choose is a big deal. Okay, so the last slide here is the authentic person. Any other ideas about authenticity? What makes you feel more authentic?
You haven't talked about emotion yet.
Okay, talk about it.
Well, it seems to me that when you run into somebody who's really convicted about what they believe, it's more of an emotional conviction for some emotional reason that they believe that, rather than a rational thinking through. The rational thinking through is developed to support the emotion.
Couldn't have said it better. Perfect. Yeah, it's Hype. Yeah, that's Jonathan Hype. Yes, sir.
And this is not exactly an answer, but just a thought. There's a lot of research I've read about, and thank you, say your mind is really almost plastic in the sense that you can be molded into different behaviors and different places. I mean, your brain has that ability. So to me, that just shows how it sounds like it's pretty tough to decide what's the authentic self, because you're really choosing between different potential selves. Like if you're in a different environment, over a period of time, you become a slightly different person.
So, yeah, absolutely. I think the potential is really a great word in the sense of to what extent are we consciously deciding or consciously freely choosing among those potentials or exercising those potentials. And you're right. I mean, our environment setting are going to influence that immensely. I think something else you said kind of caught my ear is that and we talked about, I mentioned just briefly, conditioned thinking. And, you know, there's so much conditioned thinking that happens in our lives. And overcoming that conditioned thinking takes effort. Now, yes, the brain is plastic. It regenerates itself. But some of those pathways are pretty strong. And when we have to kind of create new pathways, sometimes we really have to work at it to undo some of the old ones. Yes.
I think part of being authentic is embracing change. You know, you are going to change with your environment, your age, and your role in your life at that time. You know, I'm certainly not the same person I was 20 years ago as I am now. It doesn't make me any less authentic. It means that I'm living in the role that I've used to make those authentic choices.
Okay.
That's how I look at it.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Well, one thing I was thinking of is that sometimes if you meet somebody that you really like, that person, they're your friend or whatever, or somebody special in your family that you really like, what you're seeing in that person is things that you like about yourself. You know, okay. If they're very similar to you, and if you don't realize that, then you're not going to realize all your strengths and your talents. You're not going to see that in yourself. You see it in other people sometimes.
Okay. All right.
You know, one of the things I think that's really critical is willingness to admit faults and willingness to look into things. Because it seems to me, from my observations, is that everybody, just like you're saying, has their paradigm, and they tend to support that paradigm, whatever it is. But there's got to be an opening there where you're willing to look at something somebody else presents and be willing to admit that, you know, maybe I don't have it all together, and be willing to take correction when needed. Because it's, I think the people that refuse to take correction, I mean, they got everything figured out and they got it nailed down, and by God, you're not going to change them for nothing. They're going to change you or, you know, or whatever, you know. I mean, it's like they miss a lot of stuff. And when you listen to other people and you really try to understand where they're coming from, and you're willing to say that, well, maybe they've got something I don't, and I need to really listen to that, then you start growing, and that's real critical thinking. And if you don't have that, I think you cut yourself off from an awful lot.
So the willingness to hear, take in, evaluate new information, and then the willingness to change.
The willingness to admit that maybe I don't have it all figured out.
Right, right.
Okay. Seems like there's kind of a flip side to that. To me, I think would be that you may have your own mind based on your own experience and your own critical thinking, as opposed to following what someone else said just because of some, you know, extraneous whatever.
Which means you have to have an objective measure of what the truth is. True, outside right. of both of you.
But I mean, to me, authentic is it's has just there's something intrinsic to yourself. And to figure out what that is, you do have to be open to new experience and so forth. But at the same time, to me, it means you're basing it on your own, you know, experiences, likes, dislikes, as opposed to a fashion or, you know, a trend that you're just... You know,
when I was teaching this as a longer course, I had three psychologists in the class, and one of them... had the idea when we're kind of talking about this to be able to be willing to ask the question about why are you doing or thinking what you're doing, you know, being mindful. I mean, every moment, every minute of the day, why am I doing this, or why am I thinking that? So I thought that was kind of a good exercise. David?
I think we need to be mindful that there's two dimensions here, the personal dimension and a social dimension. Personally, you know, and anybody that remembers my talk about the meaning of life, finding creativity and meaning in your life. Nietzsche said, and you like Nietzsche, that you should live your life like it was a novel, and you're the protagonist, you're the hero in this novel. You know, that's the creativity. But on the other hand, no man is an island. We're not individuals. We're all members of groups. We're in a family, a parent, a child, in a class, a profession, a political party, if you wish, an American versus, or a racial group or a religious group. And our thinking is colored by those social groups. And so we don't think as an individual. And we don't act and we don't find our meaning totally as an individual person. We find it also. So there's two dimensions.
I would also, though, say, and you bring up the next point about these groups. I know a number of you in here are members of multiple groups. And I think that you kind of exhibit some of the traits that Ken was kind of talking about, is that you're always wanting to... see new ideas, see new ways of thinking, see new, you know, being challenged about your ideas and getting new information. And I think that's why you're in those kinds of groups, because otherwise if you didn't like being challenged, or if you, you know, if you didn't want to be uncomfortable, you wouldn't subject yourself to the, as you know, the scrutiny of your colleagues. Paul?
I think there's a big difference between philosophers' forums and the outside world. Here, critical thinking is admired and respected. And if you look at the newspaper, you don't find such and such political party torn by doubt, or Taliban torn by self-reflection. The critical thinking blocks action to a certain extent in the outside world, and the world is driven by people who lack critical thinking, where critical thinking hinders them from carrying out their single-minded purpose. And so I think we're unfortunately in a minority in a world that's driven by single-minded, non-critical thinkers.
So that's also a very interesting observation about in the world today, how the major media outlets control information. And if you really want to get other information, you have to be really into searching for, and you know, the internet has become such a source of all kinds of information, but at the same time, you know, I found a magazine called Dissent Magazine, you know, and I love that magazine because that's, you know, the title says it, okay, they're dissenting against, okay, but most people never heard of that magazine. I mean, most people don't even know it exists, so I think that's an excellent.
I got a periodical called Truth.
Oh my goodness.
which party produces that?
Okay, Carl.
Ready?
Yeah.
All right, everybody, you've handled it quite nicely, but I was going to say, you want to take some out? You want to test your own critical thinking skills?
Oh, sure.
Let's fire some.
This has been great.
Harder questions, as opposed to agreement. Let's have some dissent right here. Who's going to call?
I know. Call at least one zinger. Okay.
Just illustrations, which I'll keep to myself.
Oh, okay. Okay, back here. There's one back here.
How do you think, like, your heroes, as announced in the beginning, like Nietzsche, would advise this idea and kind of the social dynamic we talked about earlier on trying to be authentic as mindfully?
As a what?
Like how you have to risk so much to actually test out a hypothesis of authenticity. How to balance that with?
Yeah. So again, we live in a social environment, and depending on which one of these thought collectives we're in, or social groups that we're in, and the way in which we maybe approach testing these ideas and who we test it with, you know, there's been a lot of people in history that have basically put themselves in jeopardy because of doing that. So I think, you know, it comes down to courage, right? I mean, I think that I, as my friends know, tend to like to, you know, talk about contravailing views and different observations and kind of not always say the politically correct thing, but, you know, sometimes there is a price to be paid for that. So I can't tell you not to do it or to do it. I'm just saying that to do it, I think there's courage involved.
Right, so my question for you is, can you really be authentic without either greatly succeeding or greatly failing? You can't. Can you have a middle ground of saying, let's judge this aspect
about
authenticity
and
thinking about this one?
You know, I don't know the answer to your question. I think that's something that each individual has got to sort of come to some feeling about themselves. And I know in my own life, the hard thing for me to do at times is I get in these ruts of not challenging myself or not evaluating the evidence or not being open to new information. So I think you've got to evaluate for yourself how you're doing. Again, it gets, you know, why are you doing something or why are you thinking something? And are you doing things you don't like to do? I mean, it's like if you're doing something you don't like to do, just quit doing it. I mean, today, decide, I don't like whatever it is, and maybe I'm doing it because all my friends do it, maybe I do it because it's expected. You know, whatever, I can choose to do something different. But it's a personal choice.
I'm not sure it's a question of it, but the fact that you are a Nietzsche fan, I just finished reading the book Beyond Good and Evil.
Okay.
Right? So the question there is, if you think critically, is there really such a thing as good and evil, or do you have to think beyond that?
Thank you. Well, See, I think you have to think beyond that, and I think it's, you know, there's so many different levels of observation and so many different levels of operation that we're in that...
But I was hoping your project from Nietzsche's viewpoint where evil and good is really something being defined, not something that...
Well, that's kind of where I was... I mean, that's kind of where I was going in the sense that good often, or our evil, is a point of view. It's a belief that I have, or maybe there's a cultural a belief that in certain cultures things are good, in other cultures things are bad. But you know, I think we make things up sometimes just to satisfy ourselves. At other times we make things up so we can live together maybe more harmoniously. Or not, you know. But yeah, good question. Let me just tell you one thing about one of my favorite quotes from Nietzsche is, and I'm not going to get this exactly right. It's going to be more of a paraphrase. But you know, we've all heard the exhortation to we should, you know, have the courage of our convictions, right? But he says, no, you should have the courage to challenge your convictions. So I love that. Okay, one more.
I don't know if I'm oversimplifying this analogy, but I feel like as a critical thinker, you're sort of like an old man on fire, and you're being fired. I'll put it in terms of like politics or the election. You're being fired these 100 mile an hour fastballs, and the example being like a 10-second soundbite. You're supposed to analyze them and come to your conclusion. But then you don't really come to your beliefs until you're challenged to, you know, after the pitch hits the glove and you have to stay waiting for your call. So it feels like you're formulating your beliefs, but you don't really come to them in your head until you read an article and you ask yourself, or somebody's asking you. But how do you, I guess my question is really, how do you neutralize emotion in yourself to effectively think critical, because it seems very difficult to separate yourself from your emotion, especially with something like politics.
Yeah, and I think that's a point Ken was kind of hitting on earlier. Well, I tend to be very emotional, but I found a strategy that sort of works for me sometimes is to acknowledge that I'm being emotional, okay? Or I ask myself, where is this reaction coming from? Okay, and then I start saying, is there other information, or is there other evidence? Or could there be other points of view about... And so, you know, I mean, I've literally actually sat down in my notebook and written down, okay, what's the contravailing view that I'm, you know, feeling, okay? And is that view is equally valid, or does it help me, or does it not help me, or is my emotion... And there's nothing that says, you know, emotions are not bad, okay? I mean, there's a reason that we have them. But I think that the ability to, you know, self-examination and to be able just to say, yes, I'm feeling this exasperation, or I'm feeling this hate right now, but why? You know, and how else could I feel? And, you know, is that other person feeling hate towards me like I'm feeling, you know, towards them?
Yeah. Sorry, that was it. We got to pay up. Don't forget to pay up. Thank you, Jack.